Hello, everyone. I'm Alicia Krauss, and welcome to the fifth episode of The Conversation, this time featuring Daily Wire's own Andrew Klavan. Please remember that our conversation is live for everyone to watch, which is lots of fun, but you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber. So subscribe to dailywire.com right now so you can join us and ask questions. And be sure to tune in on Tuesday, February 13th. That's the day before Valentine's Day. It's going to be at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific, to catch our next episode, episode number 6, featuring our very own Michael Knowles. You will not want to miss it. Michael and I always have a lot of fun in those conversations.
Really?
Not that you aren't fun.
I can't imagine what anyone would ask Knowles. Like, what does he know? Does he actually know anything?
So, okay, I'm going to give a little bit of behind the scenes here. The last time, it was Michael's first conversation. Yeah. And I think that he thought that he would be hit with a lot of Catholic questions, especially because it was around, like, Reformation Day and stuff. Right. So he admitted that he studied up. He had a couple of cigars and a couple of drinks, like, the night before. Yeah. And he was studying up because he thought he would get all of these questions about Catholicism, and I don't think we had a question come in.
No, the questions are, how do you get your hair just like that?
Just like that. And actually, one lady even asked him for romance advice. I thought that was a little odd. But it just goes to show, folks, that we do ask the questions that you ask. And, I mean, Michael Knowles didn't get any Catholic questions. He got the romance questions.
Well, if I had only known, I'd have quizzed him on Aquinas until his eyes boiled.
So we know that our editor-in-chief here at The Daily Wire, co-founder Ben Shapiro, despises Michael.
I think that's a little harsh.
I don't know about that. Detests, possibly.
I mean,
our marketing department the other day posted a video of him saying that they loved his dreamy photo, and Ben said it, quote, this is the stuff of nightmares. So, I mean, on a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being how Ben Shapiro feels about Michael Knowles,
right.
1 being how his fiance feels about him.
Uh-huh.
Where do you fall?
I would say probably closer to Ben than to the fiance. I like Knowles. Uh-huh. He's fun to kick around. There's something about it. It's his face. I don't know what it is. The minute you look at his face, you just want to insult him.
It's the Yale thing.
It's the Yale thing too. That's, you know, it's like that makes him snotty. But he's a good guy.
Yeah.
I actually like him.
All right, first question. You ready to roll?
Yep.
Here we go. From Brandy, she asks, do you think sports have helped men take out their violent tendencies in healthy ways, or do you think it fosters them? Or secret option C?
No, I think sports are good for men. You know, they actually have shown that men, more than women, when they see an action taking place, the same lights go on in their brains as when they're actually taking the action. Mm-hmm. So we get very connected to athletes in their moments of excellence, and that's what really sports is about, and that's what men are about. You know, like, it really is interesting when people, I get a lot of questions from pastors who say, why aren't men interested in religion? And I say, religion doesn't talk enough about excellence. This is what men really, really care about, is excellence in performance. You know, all kinds of different performances. And I think sports really help in that. The funny thing is when you look at animals, you know, they fight, but they don't kill each other. Not all animals, but most animals just kind of butt heads. But people really destroy each other. And so sports is actually much more natural to people than war, I think, is.
Interesting.
And I don't think it's really encourages violence.
Could sports be like the new way of challenging someone to a duel?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you watch deer and things, they butt antlers, and then the guy who wins gets all the dough.
They also mark trees with their territory,
too.
I actually think, bringing up sports, I think that in my lifetime I'm going to see football banned. Like, completely.
Know, very possibly.
And I'm a big college football fan. I'm not really into the NFL, but
they have done I was a huge NFL fan, and I find it virtually impossible to watch them since they started insulting the flag. Mm-hmm. It's not like I'm actually boycotting them. It's just I just don't want to watch these guys clean up on all this dough without paying respects.
But
to the
flag. I think that could be part of it, is you've seen the NFL lose fans, specifically conservative fans, like our audience. But I think that you also have this thing of, like, it's too much masculinity.
Yeah,
that we're seeing in society right now. And then
listeners,
I think that there will be this thing about the concussion scandal or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, I think it's tough. Although people are really into mixed martial arts, which just seems like a melee to me. So
it really is. Yeah. But it's fascinating to watch.
It is.
Spencer asks, most excellent reader of obscure tomes of Clavinicus. Clavinicus?
Clavinicus. I think it's the Latin pronunciation.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. Would you consider, there's always a word I stump in one of these conversations. I should just do bloopers of all those. Would you consider yourself to be temperamentally conservative, or is it just that you defend certain ideas that are now considered conservative?
I think that it's the latter. I'm temperamentally libertarian.
Okay.
It is very deeply imbued in my nature. It's not from teaching. It's the way I really feel that I want everybody to be happy, do whatever you want, and leave me alone to do what I want. The fact, when I was a kid, that was a liberal point of view. Mm-hmm. That was the liberal idea. It was the right-wingers who were going around saying, don't do this, don't do that, mm-hmm. and scolding everybody. But now it's the liberals who just want control over every aspect of your life. They want to tell you, you know, there are actually people going around saying, well, if you won't go out with a man who thinks he's a woman, you're prejudiced. And my feeling is, yeah, get stuffed about that. You know, there's no way I would ever do that. And it's none of your business. You know, you go out with who you want and I'll go out with who I want. That is the deepest part of my nature. It was very, very difficult for me to understand that abortion was wrong because I wanted everybody to do what he or she wanted. Just the logic of the fact that this was an actual life and you were ending it finally overrode my natural libertarianism. So that's my first position is always a libertarian position. I can be convinced of a liberal or a conservative position simply on the basis of morality.
Okay, so is there any issue that you can think of that you would have a more liberal stance?
Yeah, I've always, I was a very big supporter of gay rights, you know, I'm not, I don't like changing the definition of the word marriage. The word marriage means to me a man and a woman starting a family. But I always, I mean, even as a kid, I remember as a little kid, my father telling me that homosexuality was a kind of illness. You know, I was like maybe 12 or something like this. And that was what people thought. And he wasn't prejudiced. That's just what people thought in those days. He said it was a kind of mental illness. And I remember thinking, they're not hurting anybody. You know, leave them alone. And of course, I work in the arts, so I've worked with so many gay people that really 10 years before the gay marriage decision came down, I started to say to conservatives, you know, we really should get off this topic because people have the right to live any way they want. And so that's something that I've always been a lot more liberal about.
Interesting. So today we have our very generous sponsors over at Skillshare that are sponsoring this episode of The Conversation.
Yep.
And they are really great. What are some of the classes that you've taken over there?
Well, I started out, you know, they have something like 18,000 classes, and it's expert people like doing a series of classes on videos. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'll test them out because they're our sponsors. So I went back and I looked at their writing classes because I thought I'm an expert writer, professional lifetime writer.
And that's not just you patting yourself on the back.
No, I mean, it's how I've made my living.
That rates these things too.
That's right. So I looked at them and I thought, yeah, this is stuff that I really had to learn for myself that can save you a lot of time. Here's a person explaining to you, how do you market? How do you write? What kinds of things do you need to know to write? And I get so many people who write to me and say, how do you get started? And I always think, you know, it's not that hard, but you need somebody to tell you because it really does seem like you're climbing this wall. Mm-hmm. So Skillshare, you know, it's just professional people telling you anything about any subject that you need to know. And it's not just like for professional stuff. Mm-hmm. It's if you want to learn photography or calligraphy or take up a hobby.
I want to crochet. Can I do that there?
Yeah,
I
absolutely. When Knowles and I did Another Kingdom, our podcast, I actually looked up, how do you do a podcast?
Really?
Yeah, because we didn't have the Daily Wire support system. We did it on our own kind of, you know, it's just as a side thing. And so I thought, well, how do you do that? So I went to Skillshare. And it's really easy. I mean, they give you, if you're listening to my show, the Andrew Klavan Show, you get a limited time offer of 3 months for just 99 cents.
That's good.
I know. Skillshare, you go to Skillshare.com/Andrew99. Skillshare.com/Andrew99. You get 3 months for only 99 cents. If you act now, you can start to learn things, fulfill your New Year's resolutions. Skillshare.com.
It is New Year's. Did you have any New Year's resolutions?
I don't have New Year's resolutions. I have New Year's plans. I think what I'm going to work on this year and what things I hope to accomplish.
But isn't that like the definition of a resolution?
Yeah, well, it's not like things like I want to get in shape or something like that. It's just more like what work I'm planning.
I actually have a friend who is a writer here at the Daily Wire, and she says that she doesn't go to the gym the entire month of January because she needs all those people to weed themselves out.
It only takes about a week, I think. Yeah.
But you're a hiker.
I am a hiker.
Go to the gym, and you do that year-round, so you're not just...
Right. I don't like the gym. I don't like repetitive things. So
interesting.
Hiking is always interesting and fun.
Oh, cool. Let's move on to more questions.
More questions.
Samuel Q wants to know, hey, Klavan, what would you suggest to someone who feels far from God? For a long time now, prayer and the sacraments have felt like nothing to me. I want to love God more, but I don't know what to do.
I actually do feel there's a way to do this. Mm-hmm. I feel that you should pray. And don't just pray in your mind. Don't just pray while you're like driving around. Go somewhere where you're alone, where nobody can hear you, and pray out loud. and really talk, you know, talk to God. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is, God is real. He's actually there. So if you talk to him, he's going to respond. He might mm-hmm. not respond in the way you think. It might take a little time for you to understand what he's saying. But talk out loud, and that way you finish your sentences, you hear what you're thinking, you understand what you're talking about, mm-hmm. and you also understand some of the things that you say, well, you think, well, maybe that's not what God wants me to bring to him. Maybe that's something that I have to work out in another way. Mm-hmm. But the important thing is I believe that you should couple that with reading the New Testament. And the reason for that is simple. When you first go to God, it's very easy to confuse him with other authority figures in your life, some of whom may have failed you. In my case, I had to get past layers that reminded me of my father, who I didn't have a good relationship with. And I think, you know, that's not the God I'm reading about in the Gospels. That sounds more like my old man, mm-hmm. you know? And so I would start to peel those layers away and get closer and closer to God. And over the course of years, I really did develop a very, very intimate relationship with the King of heaven and earth. That can't mm-hmm. be a bad thing. You know, it's good to have influence. So I think that those things, I find the sacraments very helpful. I find the liturgy and the Episcopal Church very helpful. But the important thing is that you are in relationship with God.
And having that one-on-one time.
I think
and not just doing it at church.
I think that's the best place to begin.
Yeah. Great. Brandon Valencia says, Supreme Overlord Clavin. I mean, I love these.
At least they have my name right now.
Which is the best true crime TV show you've seen recently? Which TV show is your guilty pleasure? And he says that his is True Detective. I'm presuming his favorite crime show is True Detective. And then his guilty pleasure is Fuller House. Well, so must be a child of the 90s.
True Detective, if he's talking about the HBO, that was not a true crime show, right? That was an actual fiction show. We're talking about Matthew McConaughey one, yeah. I mean, I
guess maybe the Fox or the FX series about O.J. Simpson, even though it was fictionalized,
yeah,
maybe that would be more true crime.
I'm not as big a true crime fan as a lot of people mm-hmm. are. I mean, I liked the movie The Bank Job, which is with Jason Statham, with a lot of people haven't seen, mm-hmm. and is based on a true story. My favorite,
I have seen that one.
It was a really good movie.
The wardrobe is great in that movie.
Well, I didn't notice that. I mean, I my favorite crime show on TV was The Shield, seconded very closely mm-hmm. by The Wire. I thought those were two exceptionally great shows. My guilty pleasure, and it is a guilty pleasure, is Blue Bloods. Blue Bloods.
Wow, it's still in like the law enforcement like crime vein.
The Blue Bloods is the most conservative show on television.
My mother says that. She's been trying to get me to watch that show forever. My gramps loves it. My uncle loves it. My mom loves it. She says the same thing.
I mean, Tom Selleck has a say, obviously, in the content of the show.
Yeah.
And they keep trying to push it to the liberal side because as the writers change in the writers' room, they're always liberals coming in. But they keep pushing back a little bit. So you get the family prays, they go to church, they care about law enforcement.
Yeah.
They will show black leaders as being exploitative and race baiting and things like this. It's not an innovative show, but it is my guilty pleasure. I can't stop watching it.
Interesting. Well, I mean, Tom Selleck is on the hot old guy list because only two men can carry off that stash.
Me and Tom.
No. Oh. Sam Elliott. Sam Elliott.
He knows, not even a hesitation. No. Sorry. I'm just happy it wasn't like Thunderbolt where the chair just opened up and dumped me through the floor.
Oh, this is funny. Apparently Sean Spicer is watching.
Oh, Sean Spicer is watching.
Sean Spicer asks, all right, Clavinator, deadly assassin and evil instrument of the loathsome Skynet, what should I do with 2 days in London?
Oh, great question. Great question. Well, first, I mean, there's so many sites. London is a great tourist city. Mm-hmm. Unlike New York, unlike LA, it is actually a great tourist
now.
City.
I've lived in both of those places, I think they're great tourist cities.
What do you come to see in L.A.? It's Hollywood stars' homes.
But, no, I ignore that.
But London, I mean, it has some of the greatest museums. The National Gallery mm-hmm. is a great museum. I personally like the National Portrait Gallery, where you get a lot of history as well.
Okay.
And if you are in London for 2 days, I strongly recommend that you go to the theater, especially mm-hmm. the National Theater. Every actor in England is great. There is not a bad actor. Every single, I think the entire island must just have good actors because I've never seen a bad performance in an English theater. And theater, because they really only have that one major capital city, mm-hmm. theater is still a way that the intellectual and artistic classes speak to one another. So they have important theater. They have mm-hmm. theater that matters in the same way we have television shows that matter because we don't really have, we're all spread out over the country. So I definitely go to the theater. I definitely go to one of the galleries, probably the National Gallery. I would also take a long walk. I take a long walk through the center of the city. Best walking city in the world.
Okay. Yeah. So long walk through the center of the city.
Yep. One of the art galleries and go see a show.
Okay. Yeah. 3 things, 2 days. Can it be done?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sweet. And I mean, fish and chips. A pint somewhere?
No. Oh, a pub, definitely a pub.
Gosh.
But don't order the fish and chips.
Please remember our conversation is live for everyone to watch. So hello everyone watching on YouTube and Facebook. But you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber. So go now to dailywire.com to subscribe and join us. And that's how we are getting the questions. And we promise we take the questions in the order that they are received. We don't show any special precedent over, you know, men and
Sean
women
Spicer
here.
Didn't,
I don't know. I mean, if it was Sean line. Spicer, you know, just no questions from Steve Bannon. So Skillshare is our generous sponsor for this episode of The Conversation. And, you know, I think I'm really going to check it out for that crocheting.
It is absolutely great. 18,000 classes, experts, they just give you, and it's all like, you know, you don't have to, they don't stop in the middle of the class. They give you the whole class. You don't have to pay extra. It's not like one of those things like in-app purchases.
Oh,
you know? They just
so
give
annoying.
You the entire class. And it's experts, you know, teaching you what they know, whether it's like design or the writing or calligraphy, photography, anything you want to do, any kind of new skill you want to learn. One of the things you asked me about resolutions, this is not really a resolution,
okay.
but something that I'm kind of planning is I'd like to take up an instrument again. I used to play the guitar and I now have a keyboard. And so I'm going to go take a look and see if they have some things that just help me at
nice.
Least understand music a little better. I don't think they'll have, they may not have music lessons, but they might have things that help me understand music. It's just really, it's really useful. I mean, it's a really useful tool and people should check it out. And if you listen to The Andrew Klavan Show, you can get a limited time offer of 3 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents, which is better. You know, they used to offer you a month for free, but 3 months for 99 cents is almost as
how much of a course do you think you can get done in that time?
Oh, you can get a whole thing.
Really?
Oh, several.
So you're
gonna, because I mean, they're like 13, you know, episodes or
yeah.
something like that. So you can get a lot of classes done in that time. So what you do is you go to Skillshare.com/Andrew99. Skillshare.com/Andrew99. You got to use that so they know I sent you and they'll keep sponsoring our shows. And that will give you 3 months of Skillshare for only 99 cents. Skillshare.com, Andrew 99.
I'm going to check it out.
It's cool.
So then you can play an instrument and I can crochet alongside.
In rhythm
start
to
like
my
a
playing.
New YouTube channel. Like crocheted. I can
like
be the
act.
Percussion, but with the crochet needles.
It's an act.
It's a good idea.
You've got it going.
It's totally an act that you would like see in the West Village or something dumb. Cody Martin says, I'd like you to expand on what you said the other day about your most sexist belief, that men build a field, then women get into it, then the field dies. You gave the example of Anchorman.
No, that is not exactly what I said.
Okay. I'm curious because I didn't hear this episode.
Yeah, no.
Thanks for bringing it up.
It is not what I said. What I said was that when you see women demanding and getting an equal place in a profession, it means the profession has become irrelevant. Because first of all, this is the thing. The thing I hate about feminism, the reason I'm an anti-feminist, is what it does is it takes male values and it imposes them on women. And look, there are all ranges, all kinds of women, but more women stay on the feminine side, more men are on the masculine side. And what feminism does is says the masculine values are right. Work, career, money, prestige. These are the things that men naturally want. Women, you know, sometimes that's not what they're even interested in. You know, they're interested in family. They're interested in relationship, in life. You know, thank God. I mean, to me, those things make femininity and women make life better for everybody. And so I think
on our last conversation, you actually said something interesting that you believe that certain language shouldn't be used around women because women typically elevate a situation.
I think they do.
So that analogy kind of goes against what you were saying.
So all I'm saying is this. It's men who tend to do things like say, I have an idea. What if I jump off this cliff and see if a Kleenex will keep me from landing, you know, too fast. And they invent a new sport, right? And so now you have men jumping off, you know, Kleenex jumping, and they're jumping off cliffs, and they're jumping off buildings, and jumping off. And this goes on for a while, and pretty soon people start to get bored with it. And that's when you see women start to say, we demand 50%, that you hire 50%, and the guys are already moving on to a new sport. And they say, go ahead and take it. If you see in the news business, when it mattered who was on television doing the news, it was all men. Now, there are all kinds of anchormen because nobody watches the news anymore. Movies are being taken over right now. Women are demanding a place. Nobody goes to the movies anymore. Movies don't matter. Only Spider-Man movies matter.
So you're saying then is essentially an industry starts to die. Are you blaming the industry dying because of the women taking over?
No. It's just because men have now moved on to something else.
Oh, so you're saying it's a sign that men have moved on and now women actually...
That's right, because plenty of...
Are you actually making the time's up argument for people because you're saying that there's only space for women when all of the men have gone away?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And because the men, you know, like there's a a video game that's about to come out called the Star Citizen. Probably more people will play this video game in the first 6 months that it exists than have ever seen the film Wonder Woman or ever will. In the first 6 months, okay? Mm-hmm. It's going to be 5 years before women start to say, we should, by golly, we should have an equal share of Star Citizen. Because then, by then the guys are going to be inventing some three-dimensional thing that they'll be floating around. It's just the way it works. It's a sexist theory, but it's true.
Steven Sundell says, Commander K, our public discourse has come under the control of a cadre of radical leftist kids at the social media giants. How do we resist this clear and present danger to the Republic?
It is a clear and present danger to the Republic. If you will notice, I just wrote about this in City Journal, there is not one important right-winger, you cannot name one important right-winger who wants to silence anyone on the left, who wants to censor anyone on the left. You can hardly name a left-wing redoubt, a left-wing outlet that doesn't want to silence every right-wing voice.
Yep.
Why? Because right-wing ideas work and left-wing ideas don't. And the only way to promote left-wing ideas, if that's where you get your power and your prestige and your sense of virtue from, is to silence the arguments against it, because the arguments against left-wing ideas are right. My question is, why don't right-wingers establish businesses like YouTube, Twitter, Facebook? We don't seem to go into the communications industry. We never care about the arts. We never, you know, we support arts like opera and ballet, but we don't support the living arts. We tend to turn our noses up at, you know, at new forms of of creativity. And I think that that is one of the real problems. And I think that I would like to see more young right-wingers think about how to sell their ideas, how to tell stories. You know, I'd like to see fewer right-wingers pointing at charts with a stick and more making television shows, building TV studios, buying women's magazines, every women's magazine, every comedy show is all left-wing, relentless left-wing propaganda. And we just don't pay attention to that. And the problem with it is you can win political fight after political fight after political fight. 20 years down the line, those things have eroded the values that built those political victories, and you'll start to lose. And that's the problem. I think we really need to take back the culture. Very important.
Raisin for you. Raisin for you.
Oh, that's the guy's name.
Okay, sure.
Still Sean Spicer. That's one of his handles. That's
any thoughts on the recent development regarding New California?
I don't know what that is.
Is it a part of the six-state solution? I know that that was somebody that that's been something that I think that liberal Tom Steyer had supported, that he wanted to turn California into six different states.
Great idea.
Does anybody know the new? Should we Google this?
Yeah, we can. I don't really know what it is, so I really don't have an opinion. I actually would not mind if they broke up California. It is a tremendously poorly run state. We have so much poverty, so much homelessness, so much wealth and beauty that it should really be one of the richest states in the country.
Okay, here we go. New California would apparently declare independence from California in a bid to become the 51st state.
So it would be turning into two states.
So this just happened.
Can we put all the liberals in one half of it?
They want to take over most of current day California, including many of the rural counties, and leave the coastal urban areas to themselves. So we'd still be stuck in LA. We'd be in the coastal urban area.
But still, I would compete with liberals in any time, any place, as long as they don't get to take our tax dollars.
Okay.
As long as Donald Trump's tax plan goes into effect and they don't get to subsidize their high taxes with federal tax money.
Okay. So urban California.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know how they're going to do that because the Bay Area is super liberal.
We'll build our own cities. We'll have better cities in 10 minutes. Bring it on,
so
New
apparently
California.
Andrew Klavan is a fan of secessionism. Did I say that right? Kevin wants to know, given the immense divide between the left and the right, what is something that we can all work toward to help bring the parties closer?
You know, what I tell you, this is my own pet peeve, but I'd really like to see is I really would like to see the question of homelessness addressed by right-wingers and left-wingers sitting down together. I mean, if you live in L.A., you drive around and there are tent cities all over the place.
Yep.
When I was in New York, it was 5 degrees below zero. There were guys on the street with their dogs begging. That's that's just not right. Mm-hmm. That doesn't have to be. And the thing about it is, the thing that bothers me about it, and I'm going to have somebody come on the show and try to explain this to me because I don't know the answer, is it wasn't always like this. Hmm. There didn't always used
so
to be a homeless
from?
Problem. And I am convinced that some of it has to do with the fact that we have absconded from taking care of the mentally ill. And part of this is because of left-wing theories that mentally ill people have a right to choose for themselves. No, they don't. They have no more right to choose for themselves than children do. If your mind is broken, you're not capable of that. That's when you take care of people. That's when you look out for them. A guy living out in the street because he's not sane enough to get housing needs help. So these are problems where at least a right winger and a left winger can sit down and at least begin the conversation. This ain't right. It ain't right for a guy to be out in the cold at, you know, 5 degrees.
And something that they could actually both agree on.
And if we can agree that it ain't right, maybe we can start to find the next step is what might work to bring it to an end.
Okay. Blake wants to know, if leftism is a mental disorder, what existing DSM diagnosis does it most closely resemble?
I don't actually think liberalism is a mental disorder. I think that Ronald Reagan came very close to it. He said it's not that liberals don't know anything, it's that so much of what they know is wrong. When I talk to liberals, almost exclusively, mm-hmm. they really don't have a good grasp of the facts. And they I say that, I know that sounds condescending.
But look at where they're getting their facts from.
They get it from Paul Krugman writes a column in the New York Times, an economic column, that is relentlessly untrue. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost every word that he writes is untrue. And I go to New York and I talk to friends who read the New York Times and they quote it to me. And I say, yeah, but that's not true. Those mm-hmm. aren't the facts. I really think that that leftists are trying to get to something, a fairer world, a nicer world, mm-hmm. a better world, and they just don't understand that some of the things, this is kind of funny. Leftists don't understand that some of the things that actually achieve their goals look harsh. Capitalism looks harsh, but it actually has lifted more people out of poverty mm-hmm. than any socialist program ever anywhere,
yeah.
okay? So it looks harsh, but it actually is much more fair. Hmm. In the same way, conservatives, when they look at the arts, don't understand that sometimes the harshest work of art, like The Sopranos, filled with sex and violence and bad language, is actually a very moral show. Hmm. So sometimes the way things look create an illusion that fool people on both sides. I really don't think leftism is a mental disorder, but I do think it's ill-informed, and I think that it is promoted by people who want power. And because they want power, they are in positions of power. Like a guy like me, I don't really want power from anybody. I just want to do what I want to do, you know? But if you want power and you own NBC, CBS, ABC, The New York Times, CNN.
Or you're an influential politician.
Yeah, or you're mm-hmm. an influential politician. You're going to promote left-wing ideas, even knowing that they don't help anything because they just increase your power.
Interesting. I think that's a really good point. Tim Bauer wants to know, why can't Republicans just do DACA and chain migration and whatnot and then just tell the whimpering Dems, thanks for stopping by? Seems like fixing DACA would be a popular win.
The reason they can't do it is because we've lost our trust in the government to actually to actually secure our borders. Mm-hmm. So the Democrats keep saying the same thing. They say, just give us DACA and down the line we'll secure our borders. Mm-hmm. DACA is an emergency, but we can always secure our borders. And they never secure the borders. We know now from this memo that the Daily Caller released, we know that they're importing voters. They want to bring in these people because they feel that they are reliable Democratic voters. They don't want to secure the borders. They don't have an affection for America. I think we just got through 8 years of a president who didn't really like this country mm-hmm. very much, who thought it was helping this country to bring in thousands and thousands of people who disagreed with everything we stand for because he didn't really agree with everything mm-hmm. that we stand for. I think that we do not trust the government to shut those borders down and establish the rule of law. And for me, by the way, immigration is a rule of law issue. Hmm. It's not an issue of where people come from. It's a question of we decide, not them. So the reason I say that is we make the laws, enforce them, and if we need more people, and we think, you know what, we need more people from Mexico, let's change the law, mm-hmm. bring in more people. We have a wonderful government there to change the laws if we need them to change the laws. I do not understand why certain laws like abortion that is now apparently enshrined in our Constitution magically, I don't understand why that law should be obeyed, but suddenly we don't obey the laws at the border. Hmm. It's insane. And so I just think we don't trust them to secure the border and establish rule of law. Once they do that, I think they'll find the American people are very, very forgiving of dreamers and people who are here already. I think once they say, okay, we've got the E-Verify in place, we've got the wall in place, nobody's coming across, I think Americans will say, all right, if you're here, fine. There's a path to something or other, some form of citizenship. I think they will say that after they establish security, not before.
Interesting. Please remember, this is just a friendly reminder to everybody watching our live streams right now that our conversation is live for everyone to watch, but you can only be a part of it and ask questions if you are a subscriber. So subscribe to dailywire.com now and join us in this episode of The Conversation. Sam Dove says, hi, Andrew. Do you think that some of the actors and actresses who wore black to the Golden Globe should be commended for standing up against sexual harassment?
No.
Not one of them? No.
I think that, first of all, everybody knows what's going on in Hollywood. Hollywood is a place where there's a lot of transactional sex. And I have been in rooms, my own personal self, where I have seen women come in dressed provocatively, flirting egregiously with people, hoping to get a part. And I know that they sleep with people to get parts. This is part of the way Hollywood works. To suddenly get on your high horse and say, oh, and now we're standing up and how valuable we are and how virtuous we are, and now we're wearing black dresses. I would have liked to see them wear gray sweatsuits. You know, they didn't do that. They were very glamorous
with
black
no hair
dresses.
And makeup.
You know, like, yes, I look marvelous in my black dress? Aren't I a hero? These people aren't heroes. These are actors and actresses. They're very good at pretending to be heroes. I mean, it's just, you know, the actor-actress thing is just one of the failures of evolution because we've evolved to trust our eyes, and actors and actresses look like really nice people because they're so pretty and attractive and wealthy and adored. Most of them are just not that bright, you know, and I think that these are not heroic people. They're not changing anything. They're not really making an important statement. They're people who sat around while Harvey Weinstein, who, in my opinion, if half of what they say about him is true, he belongs in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, they let that go on and they didn't say anything about it, and now they're parading their virtue, and it's ridiculous. I think Oprah knew, I think Meryl Streep knew, I think they all knew, and now they're going to be, these virtuous people. I want us to talk about the women who came forward and were silenced, who actually reported things to the police at the time it happened and weren't listened to. Then I'll agree that you're a hero. You wait 20 years and then you make unprovable allegations against people. I'm just bored.
Well, and it's also interesting that none of the women that were at the forefront of coming forward, specifically some of Harvey Weinstein's accusers, were not mentioned or invited to or praised at the Golden Globes.
To me, feminism ruins everything. There's certainly, I think treating people badly, whether they're male or female, is bad. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something we can actually agree on. You know, we shouldn't treat people badly. We should treat each other with respect. Sex is a very powerful force, and everybody, I think, sometimes acts badly when in the grips of sexual desire. Mm-hmm. But people with so much power that they can get away with the kind of mistreatment that was going on in Hollywood, that's just something that's very, very difficult to police without starting a witch hunt, without firing people for things that you can't prove that they did. Mm-hmm. I'm not that impressed with this whole thing. I really feel like women... First, I feel that the sexual mores should change, that maybe we should start to teach women that you want some commitment before you let people jump on your bones. That's the first
thing. Something I think we're seeing with the Aziz Ansari accusation.
Exactly. It's about time that women start to realize that, you know, the consequences of sex for them are much higher than for men, both emotionally and physically. Mm-hmm. And so there should be a higher price. They should think about them as being more valuable, treat themselves as more valuable than they are. And also they should stop listening to feminists. Everything feminists tell them is untrue. Everything it tells them about their nature is untrue. Everything it tells them about men and women is untrue. Stop listening. Start listening to the people who have been writing and talking about this for thousands of years and have gotten it right.
Do you think that this is going to ruin award season?
Oh, award season to me is the dullest. I mean, award season, look.
I mean, but there are some people that I actually think it shows that Hollywood was so out of touch with their audience, who are, you know, middle American, mainly women, and I'm sure the vast majority are also gay guys, that are watching like the red carpet and they want to see these movies and they want to see their favorite actress and who is she wearing and what is she wearing and, you know, what movie is she working, what project is she working
on
next.
That was ruined by politics a while back.
But I mean, and then to make it this like all black thing, and E, not asking who are you wearing, but why are you wearing black, it kind of takes the fun out of it for people that really just want an escape.
Of course. I mean, this is one of the things that happens to an art form when it dies. An art form at its peak, which is usually very early on, is something that not only the public likes, but intellectuals like. Hmm. So you put on Shakespeare and the place is packed because the jokes are funny, there's sex, there's dueling, but there's also this beautiful poetry. So intellectuals can sit there and say, wow, this is actually a brilliant play, even though the normal people are enjoying it for all the action and the sex and the romance. When an art form starts to die, those two parts begin to separate. Mm. Then you have to start to have novels like Ulysses so that only intellectuals can read, and novels like detective stories that intellectuals shun. And that's what's happened to the movies now. Mm. Now you're giving, it's not that they can't make good movies, and it's not that they can't make movies people watch. They can't make good movies that people watch. So they're giving the Oscar to a picture like Moonlight, which was a fine little TV show, a little sliver of a slice of life, but nobody cares about the life of a black gay man in the ghetto. Nobody cares. I mean, nobody wants to see that movie. Nobody saw it. Nobody's going to see it. It's never going to have an effect on anybody, and it can be a nice little piece of arty intellectualism, but it's no longer movies as we thought of the movies, where the best movies, the movies that won the Oscar, were also the movies that people loved. You know, and that those days are gone. And that's why award season is over. Award season is over because they're no longer talking about the movies that people like, because the movies that people like no longer deserve awards.
Interesting. Veronica Young says, how about that conservative think tank? What's your advice for conservatives who want to impact the culture artistically? How do we navigate the censorship and bigotry?
This drives me a little bit crazy because I mean, I know a lot of the think tank guys. Mm-hmm. They're all such good people. They are good thinkers. They think about wonderful things, but none of them thinks about the arts, and none of them thinks that that is a specialist field. Mm. So in other words, there are people who write. Yeah, I don't want to. You can name all of the conservative think tanks. There are people at those think tanks who might enjoy the arts and write about them, but none of them are people who have lived in the arts, who practice the arts, who study the arts. None of them, because conservatives don't care about them. And I think that that was the thing that Andrew Breitbart, he said he wanted me to be the first president of his think tank, which was going to be a cultural think tank. And I said, okay, you know, do it. You know, and then of course he passed away. But I think that that is a think tank that needs to be started. Like arts, like what makes art moral? What makes it wise? Why is it that conservatives might shun a program like Game of Thrones, and yet Game of Thrones might be seen as a very conservative work of art in some ways? Why is it that they shun The Sopranos, but The Sopranos is in my mind a deeply Christian, deeply moral work of art with its roots very deep in Judeo-Christian thinking. And so people who understand the arts and can explain them to a conservative public could bring conservatives to the arts, not just as appreciators, but also as creators. Mm. And I think that is a think tank, or at least a department in a think tank that we need very, very badly. I've been making this case for years, but it's like banging your head against the wall.
Wayne Goble wants to know, in your series, Another Kingdom, which is what you mentioned earlier, and it's over on Ricochet, and you and Michael do it.
Or iTunes, anywhere you get a podcast.
I believe I heard you use the word yin to describe the goodness of one of your characters. Is this unintentional with yin referring to darkness and yang to light?
No, it was referring to her femininity. There's a woman in it named Jane Janeway, who is a very, very feminine girl who the hero is slowly, slowly falling in love with. Mm-hmm. And she's a girl who takes care of people. She's a girl who nurtures people. She's a girl who sits, you know, as he says, when he comes in and he's hurt, she actually kisses it and makes it better. And he says, and it works. It's this insane thing. So he refers to her magic yin at one point. You know, Another Kingdom, one of the themes of Another Kingdom, and one of the reasons I'm finding it almost impossible to sell to Hollywood, is manhood. And you can't have manhood without womanhood. You can't have masculinity without femininity. And it is about the kind of interrelations. It's about a guy who is a Hollywood guy who walks through a door one day and finds himself a murder suspect in this bizarre other kingdom. But in this bizarre other kingdom, there are rules and customs and mores in place that have gone out of fashion in L.A. Hmm. And so he starts to learn, hey, maybe some of these things are still a part of me somewhere inside, and maybe there's a way to be a man and bring that manhood back into the world of L.A. And that's part of the theme of it. And she's just one of the characters who he starts to realize, you know, she's really a much better person than he understands at first. And he starts to understand her femininity in a new way.
And so you decided to use that word to
describe her. Used it as he's describing it. He's kind of waxing poetical about it, and he describes it.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Luke Jackson says...
they're leaving out the vowels because in all these millennial products like movement watches. They give out the vowels, so it's KLVN.
Oh, there you go. Do you believe that profiting despite an evil is immoral, even if the act has or already will be committed? So stem cell research using the stem cells from aborted babies, for example.
Yeah, I think, you're creating the market for that by using them. And especially, I mean, I think that there is something really horrifying about the idea of creating embryos to use the stem cells, especially when it seems pretty likely that you can do it another way. Mm-hmm. And so if you are doing that, to say that somebody's going to do it so I'm going to profit from it is basically to create the market for it. People have to stand up and say, you know what, there's some things we don't do because they're simply wrong. And selling, you know, embryo body parts is one of them.
Johnny B. says, postmodernism a separate era, or is it just the decadent end of modernism?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think that it really depends on where you define modernism. There are some people who start thinking about modernism basically with the Reformation. So they basically say Don Quixote, which is, after all, is a novel about novels, is a modernist novel. Shakespeare is a modernist writer, in which case I don't think that modernism is necessarily decadent in and of itself, but since all things decay, postmodernism is the way that modernism would decay. And the reason I know that is because at the very beginning of modernism, which would be Hamlet, essentially, Hamlet has a mad scene in which he discusses postmodernism. He talks about the fact that words have no meaning. They say, what are you reading? He says, I'm reading words. You go like, what does that mean? Well, that's a very postmodern thing to say. Uh-huh. He talks about the fact that when his mood changed, the entire nature of the world changes. That's Shakespeare predicting what will happen after the Reformation. He's predicting what will happen after the church loses its monopoly on moral truth. So postmodernism is the necessary end of modernism, but it is the decadent end of modernism. And I think now we are just moving into that's what I think is exactly happening now, is we are now realizing that relativism, multiculturalism, postmodernism, whatever you want to call it, simply is untrue and internally unsound, and it's disappearing. And I believe there's going to be a religious revival at the very intellectual top. I believe it's happening as you and I are sitting here.
Really?
That, yes, in some of the greatest universities in the country, I believe young people are getting together and starting to talk about religion and starting to say, you know what, maybe when we left this Jesus guy behind, we left behind everything with him, and maybe coming back and find him again. I think that is going to happen. I actually think that if I can stay healthy, I will live to see some of that happen.
Interesting. Stephen Sindel says, esteemed Sayer of the Sooths, radical leftist teachers in high school are abusing their position by indoctrinating kids into their radical views. How do we fight this insidious threat?
Wow, you know, people are always asking this. I always worry that when people ask this, what they're really asking is, how do we fight this insidious threat without having to pay a price? And the answer is you can't. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line, somebody has to stand up and shout these people down and fight back. Mm. And I shouldn't say shout them down. I mean, argue with them.
Well, full disclosure, I have a child that's going to kindergarten next
year.
There
you go.
So my husband and I have been doing the school hunt here in Los Angeles. And at a few of these schools, we have seen pictures of hashtag She Persisted and Hillary Clinton on the wall at teachers' desks,
right,
in open view.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what? Don't talk to my kids about sex, religion, and politics. That's my job at home.
Right.
Just, you know.
My entire...
Hooked on phonics, the vowels, like algebra, stuff like that. So, but if I say something, I then risk my child being ostracized or not being able to get into a school that might potentially be the best school for her.
Right.
So you're right. There is the risk, but what risk is that?
I think you have to speak up, because if nobody speaks up, then everybody assumes that everyone agrees. So once you speak up, I think other people will start to speak up. And because they're wrong and because they know they're wrong, sometimes just the force of another voice will force them to back down. I had, a lot of my life was defined by the fact that I refused to let my children go to public schools. And I did a lot of work that I might not have done to get them through some of the very pricey schools that I sent them to, simply so that when I went in and said, hey, you know what? You can't say that. That's not right. They had to listen to me, you know? And I'm a very civilized guy. I always got along with their teachers. Most of their teachers, 80, 90% of their teachers were great. I wanted the right to question them. I didn't want them to say, you know, this is a public school, you have no right to say anything. And I think that you have to speak up. You have to be a voice for values. Not to shut anybody else up, but simply to point out that they are shutting people up. Because that's the flaw in their logic. The flaw in their logic is not that anyone is stopping them from speaking. It is that they are always stopping other alternative voices. And I think that if you can bring that out, sometimes you can shame them into telling the truth.
So if I do end up bringing my kid to one of these really expensive schools, can you just come with me?
Yeah, exactly. I'll stand behind you in a pinstripe suit with a cigarette in my, you know. This
is my enforcer.
Exactly.
We only have a little bit of time left, so let's keep rolling through all these. Blake Conrad says, Lord Klavan, what is the cure for toxic femininity?
Well, first of all, one of the things about this is that most of us only have one really important woman in our lives. Mm-hmm. Choose carefully. This is the first thing. You know, I mean, I have had a miraculously beautiful marriage, and a marriage that has inspired me and uplifted me. My wife hates it, but
for you, it's been real good.
For me, it's been great. And I think the thing is, you know, my wife is an extraordinarily feminine woman and a person who really dedicated herself to making a life for me and our kids. And I think when you have that in your life, a lot of other things don't matter. A lot of things that other people are doing don't really matter. But my approach to toxic femininity, and I lived through some of the worst eras of feminism, including the 80s, and I think it's come back now. My attitude was to ignore it. And I opened doors for women, as you said. I treated women like ladies. I treated women as I wished women wanted to be. And much of the time, it was who they wanted to be. They wanted to be treated like ladies. It was only the exception who would stop. And this would happen to me. They would stop and yell at me on the street. You know, why are you opening the door for me? And I would say, well, I thought you were a lady. Sorry. You know, and they would find that very offensive. What's really interesting is I was in New York for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And not only under the effect of Donald Trump, I believe, were people aggressively wishing each other Merry Christmas instead of Happy Holidays, which was a big change. But I'm counting about five times when I would open the door for a woman, she would stop, turn to me, look me like dead in the eye and say, thank you. That was such a nice thing of you to do. Thank you so much. And then go through the door. And I would be sitting there like going, I guess things are changing because that's not the way it used to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said that if you stand where you are, the great world will come around. Mm-hmm. And that's been my approach to toxic femininity, which I just regard as feminism. I think feminism was a bad idea. I think its time is passing. I think we need it. I'm an individualist. I want everybody to do what he or she wants. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like putting any restrictions on anybody. But I think that when women come to their senses and stop succumbing to the social pressure that has been created by the left, I think that maybe they will change the whole culture.
I wonder how many times in a conversation we can get Andrew to say that he doesn't like feminists.
I do not like. Did I say that? Did I mention that already?
Feminists, feminism. I mean, different.
Well, because nobody wants to say it, you know, so I say it.
Once again, this is just a friendly reminder that our conversation is live for everyone to watch, but you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber to The Daily Wire. So go to thedailywire.com right now and join us, subscribe to join us in this conversation. And don't forget, the next conversation is going to be next month on February 13th with Michael Knowles.
Oh,
George says, did you ever regret just throwing away thousands of dollars worth of bar mitzvah presents? And did your parents ever find out? If they did, what happened?
They didn't ever find out. The really weird thing about this, I write about this in my book, The Great Good Thing, which is about my conversion. And one of the things that happened, I got thousands of dollars worth of jewelry and savings bonds and all these things for my bar mitzvah. And then about 6 months, 6 to 8 months later, I started to think, you know, I really was lying. I didn't really believe in any of the things I said at my bar mitzvah, so this is ill-gotten gains. And I crept out very late at night, and I threw this leather box full of jewelry away. And I just stuffed it into
some dumpster diver was real pleased with that.
I know. Somebody,
Do people know what that is? I'm from the land of dumpster divers. It's more of a redneck thing.
I always wondered if the garbage man found it. I very much doubt he did. I hid it very, very deeply. I don't think I ever did regret it. I can't remember ever regretting it. The really strange thing about it was I didn't ever really think about it again. It was just something I did thinking, well, that was the right thing to do. And then at a party I was at with a friend of mine who is an Episcopal priest with his wife and my wife, we're sitting around, and you know how you tell stories at a party? And I told that story. And the party sort of stopped, and this priest said to me, you know, that's a remarkable story. And I paused because here I am a professional storyteller, and I'd never told, and I thought, you know, that is kind of a remarkable story. And it started me to thinking about why I had done it, why it had mattered so much to me to have done it. It was the first time it ever occurred to me that maybe God mattered to me because, not the first time it ever occurred to me, but one of the times it occurred to me that maybe God mattered to me or I wouldn't have, it wouldn't have been so important to me that I had lied about him. So I can't recall ever regretting it. My parents never did. I never discussed it with them. So
interesting. Yeah. Caitlin Barnes says, "Master of all things, Klavan, how many seasons of Another Kingdom are you expecting to produce?"
We're very much hoping to produce three. I hope it's three seasons. The first season does resolve itself, but it also has some, you know, things that lead into the next. Yeah, cliffhangers. And we've gotten a great response the first time. I'm going to see what happens when I send the book out. I may publish the book myself. I'm not sure how I'm going to handle that. But I'm very much hoping to do a second season next year. And then I'd love to do one more and really round out the whole story. And I'm just hoping the way Noel smokes and drinks that he'll live through it.
Well, I mean, he has to live till his...
His wedding.
Through his wedding, right?
Yeah, that's true. So
and
she
then
can inherit
his sweet little Alyssa gets the life insurance,
that's
I hope,
it.
If something
that's,
happens.
That's the important thing.
It's cigar because, smoking covered in...
Because Shapiro and I are probably going to kill him anyway.
I don't know if he's... You know, this is recorded. John Rush. Andrew, you mentioned a couple of times that Christian art should be more nihilistic. I'm not sure that's what you mean, but how can a Christian accomplish real-world art without nihilism?
Yeah, I don't think I ever said that.
Okay.
What I think I have said is that nihilistic art is sometimes more realistic than Christian art, and that Christian art should be realistic.
Okay.
So what I mean by that is that good things don't always happen to good people. Not every story has a happy ending. Sometimes bad people get away with stuff.
I mean, look at life.
Exactly. And what Christians don't understand is that I think conservatives have the same problem, is Christian art doesn't look like Christian life. It looks like life. Because God is God of the real world. And so, you know, sometimes when you see, you know, a movie that I always like that's a nihilistic movie is called Open Water, about some people get lost in the water and the sharks come after them and it's just bad things happen. You know, it's just like, you know, bad breaks, terrible things happen, and then things just get worse. And that's like nihilistic art, because that's basically the philosophy that it's putting forward. But a Christian could tell that story too, but he'd have to be honest about the pain, the suffering, the tragedy, the seeming uselessness of it, because where Christianity takes place is in a timeline that goes beyond each life. So we live in a certain way, and most people do this anyway without admitting it. We live in a certain way where sometimes we don't take the immediate advantage because we want to be good people, because we want to answer to some spirit inside ourselves, maybe some spirit that created us that says, you know, I made you to be a certain way. Why is it that you don't commit rape? Why is it that you don't, you know, if one of my friends leaves his wallet down, why don't I take the money and, you know, why? I mean, if he's never going to find out, if my wife's never going to find out that I cheated on her, why don't I cheat on her? Well, it's because I actually believe I'm living a longer timeline than my life would suggest. And that I think that there is something inside me that is not just this, not just this meat, not just this flesh, that is something more important that I am trying to develop and preserve and turn into, live into what it was made to be. So I think that Christian art should be about life as it's actually lived, full of pain, full of suffering, full of unfairness, instead of like every time you have, this is what Christian movies look like to me. Every time you have a sex outside of marriage, you get pregnant. Every time, every time you don't believe terrible things happen to you. It's just absurd. And anybody looking at it, it's kind of like, rom-coms for Christians, basically, romantic comedies for Christians, where it sort of follows a certain semi-pornographic pattern, where what I want to say is, no, this life full of murder, this life full of adultery, this life full of death is Christ's life. This is the Christian life in which we have faith. That's, you read the Bible, that's what those stories are like. I mean, they're really horrific stories, full of the things of life. And that's all I'm saying, is that Christians should engage with life, not with this namby-pamby, mealy-mouthed, clean, squeaky-clean idea. It's for children. It's not for adults. And how can you sell anything to anybody if you're going to lie, if everything you say is a lie? Why, after a while, people would say, like, life's just not like that. Why should I believe in that?
Interesting. Ashton Harrell says, Overlord Klavan, how would you reconcile the modern church's view of women in religious worship with 2 Timothy 2:11-15, quote, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission?
Yeah, you know, I have a very specific approach to the Bible, and it's a developing approach. I mean, so I won't say anything that I can't change my mind about later, but I have a very deep relationship to the Gospels. I have spent years now trying to understand who Jesus was, what he was saying, you know, because he says stuff that people quote, and then you think, really? I'm sorry, what? You know, like turn the other cheek, and you go, really? Somebody hits me, I'm supposed to, do you mean that? Is that exactly what you mean? So I've read, you know, the Gospels very carefully, trying to figure out what it was he was saying. The epistles, I feel, are by men. I feel all the Bible is by men, and that means there can be errors in it and things like that. But the epistles specifically are men trying to understand this immense cosmic event. Like, I really believe that this happened. I believe that God incarnated himself, lived and died, and was resurrected on earth. And then guys were like, what the hell just happened, you know? And so some of them said things.
They're processing
it. Processing it. So not every word that they say becomes a law for all of human time, right? So I believe there's a line, I'm not sure if it's in Paul or pseudo-Paul, but where he says, you know, anybody who does this, anybody who does that, anybody who does this, is not going to the kingdom of heaven. And my feeling is, well, I'm not sure you know that. You know, I'm not sure, Jesus said, don't judge not lest you be judged. You know, what he's saying is, I don't think those are good ways to live. You know, he's picking things in that he sees around him that are threatening the church. And he says, I don't think those are good ways to live. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's a rule that God has set down, that this is those people will not get into heaven. I believe we're going to be very surprised at some of the people we meet in heaven, and I think that's going to be a good thing. It's going to be a thing that will expand our own minds and our own hearts and our own souls. I think that women should not be afraid to follow their natures. They should not be afraid to be who they are. And I think that I think that we've taught them that there's something wrong with who they are, that it's imposed on them by society, which I think is just nonsense. I think it's absolute nonsense. But everything in Christianity speaks into the nobility, the honor, the importance of the individual. God, it says in on the first page that God created man in his image, male and female. So when you are looking at a man, when you are looking at a woman, you are looking at the image of God, and you should treat that person as just like that. It's exactly how you treat them, and it's male and female created he them in his image. And I think that's basically all you need to know. That's all you need to know about how women should be treated, about how men should be treated. I think that tells you the whole thing.
Wow, Preacher Clavin there for a little bit. You only have a couple minutes left. But Steve Parker says, your thoughts on the most dishonest and corrupt media awards of the year tomorrow.
My thoughts on this are that I want to host the award show. I will buy a tuxedo. I will steal Knowles' tuxedo. I will show up. I just want to host these awards. I think it is the greatest idea that Donald Trump ever had in his entire life. I think his entire presidency may be validated by this. I think our news media is the most corrupt Democrat Pravda that, you know, I've ever seen. They're just liars. They cheat. They only tell one side of the story. And I think you could give each and every one of them a special award. And just a little golden statuette that looks like Jim Acosta. I think that's what it should be.
Tell us how you really feel. Oh, goodness. We only have a couple minutes left. Right. Maybe we have time for one or two more questions. This is our final question.
Yeah.
Okay. Kimberly Rich says, dear all-knowing Clavin, where does Shapiro and your differences of analysis from okay, sorry. Kimberly says, dear all-knowing Clavin, and I think she's asking, where do you and Ben Shapiro differ in your analysis on Trump, and where does that come from?
It's very hard to know. I mean, Ben and I do have differences of opinion. We have differences of approach to life. I mean, I think that, you know, he's an Orthodox Jew and has a very rule-based approach to life. I am a Christian and I have a much less rule-based approach to life, but maybe that's too simplistic too. I think that he is more of a political guy, and I am more of a cultural guy. So I look at the culture and I say, what's the effect this guy is having on the culture? Which I think has actually been positive, in spite of the fact that he actually does things that I don't always like. Whereas Ben is always looking at policy. He's always looking at, you know, the numbers, what the polls say, how this is going to affect the polls down the line, who's going to win the next election. I've been around a long time, and I realize that you don't always know who's going to win the election. I mean, on the day that Donald Trump won, neither Ben nor I knew who was going to win the election. So I don't worry so much about as much about the future in that regard. I look at the culture and I think, maybe it's a good thing that people are turning to their sports heroes and say, hey, stand up for the flag when they play the national anthem. Maybe it's a good thing that people are saying Merry Christmas. Maybe it's a good thing that people are not so, you know, I talked about this, I wrote an article about this week that was very popular in City Journal, where I said, you know, Trump is rude. I don't like rudeness, but that rudeness is helping to shatter the political correctness that has worked as a mental prison for all these years. The left purposely constructed this out of our manners, out of our good manners. Mm-hmm. They would say, well, it's not polite, it's not nice to say that blacks commit a disproportionate amount of crime. You go, well, that's the fact. Ah, yeah, but you're a racist if you say it. And Trump, because he's rude, because he's crude, is actually breaking through, shattering those rules. So there he is doing something that I think is wrong, but it's having a good effect on the culture, and that makes me happy. He's also just accomplished a lot of good stuff in that first year, and it was easier for me to see that than Ben in some ways. It took Ben a little bit longer, I think, to come around because he felt that he was calling balls and strikes. I feel I'm looking at the way the culture is going, the big ship of the culture. Mm-hmm. Is it headed toward the North Star or is it getting lost? Right now, I think we're in a good path. And part of that is because of Donald Trump. And so I'm much more easier on him than Ben, who's sometimes saying, well, this policy's wrong and that policy's right. And this, he has a much more political point of view. I think I have a much more cultural point of view.
Interesting. We'd like to thank our generous sponsors over at Skillshare.
Thank you, Skillshare. Don't forget
about that. And be sure to tune in on Tuesday, February 13th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific to catch our next episode, episode 6. It's going to feature our very own Michael Knowles.
Who?
And you won't want to miss it.
Oh.
Michael Knowles.
Oh.
He smokes a lot of cigars.
No.
Went to Yale.
No,
where's the glasses?
No.
Yeah, Ben hates him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now I remember.
Thanks for watching, everyone. I'm Elisha Krauss, and I'll see you next time.